only infinite, but the more we share them, the more valuable they become. That is why places that facilitate idea sharing tend to become more productive and innovative than those that don't, Romer continues. Because when ideas are shared, the possibilities do not add up, they multiply. This explains why Silicon Valley is such a hotbed of innovation, with its culture of sharing ideas in Safeway parking lots. It explains why Boston, with over 100 colleges and universities, is a vast hub of innovation. To get great ideas, just add students and shake. My favorite example of the power of collaboration is Tel Aviv, which has one of the hottest technology startup scenes in the world. During a recent visit to Israel, I asked one of our Israeli clients how their relatively small country turns out so many great companies. He pointed out that, in Israel, military service is mandatory for all young people. This means you are, in Pixar's words, smooshed together with people from different backgrounds and social classes and forced to rapidly exchange information to solve problems. A college student could find herself leading a squadron into a simulated battle. This situation not only kick-starts kids into maturing more quickly, it also helps them develop problem-solving skills based on rapid collaboration. You learn to depend on your team, to share information, and to help make your own ideas better. All fantastic skills for starting a technology business. Sharing ideas makes them better. As long as there is spillover between minds, says author Stephen Johnson in Where Good Ideas Come From, useful innovations will be more likely to appear and spread. It's not that the network itself is smart, it's that the individuals get smarter because they're connected to the network. By collaborating, we give our ideas new ways to connect. Whether it's in a supermarket parking lot, a conference room, or an auditorium, when we meet like-minded minds, we can exchange information, swap ideas, help work on a project, or indeed, whatever. Helping others helps yourself. The next best decision I made after the decision to get sober was to call my friend Mike. Mike was a recovering alcoholic, and I confess I was scared to call him. If I told no one I was getting sober, only my wife and I would know if I failed. But telling Mike was another story. Now I had another person who knew my intention. I'm not sure what I expected from Mike. Maybe a sympathetic ear or a few words of encouragement. But Mike took the bull by the horns. "Good for you," he said. "There's a meeting tonight. Let's go." Mike not only got me involved with 12-step programs, but he was brutally honest that I needed to practice helping other people. His advice was all the more powerful because Mike spends a significant amount of his time helping other recovering alcoholics, speaking at halfway houses, rehab centers, and church basements across New England. He's like the Mother Teresa of alcoholics, if Mother Teresa had a crew cut and spoke with a Boston accent. This form of collaboration, helping each other get and stay sober, is a tradition among recovering alcoholics. I could call Mike at any time of the day or night, and he would be there. What's more, he regularly reached out to me. I have a hard enough time answering text messages from my own mother, so the sacrifices that Mike makes to help others is incredibly inspiring and gives you hope for the human race. And there are many others just like Mike, an anonymous underground of help and support. Even if you're not trying to get free of addiction, helping other people is still a particularly powerful form of collaboration. When you help other people, you're also helping yourself. For example, when you teach something, you also deepen your own understanding, which is why I encouraged you to teach the concepts of mind hacking at the beginning of this book. Teaching makes us define and articulate a subject. Even when you think you know it, you don't really know it until you've explained it to someone else. Helping other people also makes you accountable. If you're helping someone else get sober, you are putting yourself in a position where you don't want to let the other person down. It strengthens your resolve to stay sober yourself, as you're now the role model. Without question, one of the best things about being a parent is that it has made me a better person. I strive to live a life that is worthy of being emulated, since I know my personal example is likely the biggest help I can give my children. When you help other people, you also alter your self-concept. You slowly move from a drunk who gets drunk to a recovering alcoholic who helps alcoholics to recover. With mind hacking, we're trying to change who we are, and nothing changes us more quickly than playing the part. If we're trying to stay sober, it's hugely beneficial to serve in a role where we have to stay sober. These benefits come to you, no matter what you're trying to achieve with mind hacking. Look for opportunities to collaborate where you can actively help others. If you're trying to start a business, get involved with an entrepreneurial networking group. If you're trying to lose weight, try weight loss support groups like Weight Watchers. If you're trying to develop the next killer app, attend mobile developer meetups. And always with the spirit of service. Not what will I get out of this, but what can I give to this? When getting my MBA, one of my favorite classes was called Leadership and Influence. In that class, I learned the powerful concept of reciprocity, the idea that if I do something nice for you, you will be favorably disposed to do something nice for me. This is why we write thank you notes, and why we feel awkward when someone gives us a holiday gift and we don't have a gift in return. It's deeply embedded in our society, possibly even in our biology. You know the mystery box in certain video games that will reward you with some mystery surprise? Maybe it's a power-up, or bonus coins, or even an extra life. Every time we help someone else, it's like dropping a mystery box that will later bring us some small, unexpected reward. Helping people makes them want to help you. Even though it's called mind hacking, we can't keep it all in our minds. We've got to collaborate, because helping others helps ourselves. Begin mind game. Share the dream. Share one of your positive loops with someone else, a friend, relative, or other trusted confidant. Be brave. Research shows that sharing your goals with someone else makes you more likely to achieve them. Write down this person's name on the practice sheet. End mind game. You're soaking in it. The mind hacking program is open source because we want it to be collaborative. But radical collaboration, like the kind that fueled Wikipedia, is radically scary. If you think it was an easy decision to post this entire book online months before mind hacking was available in stores, you'd be wrong. Traditional publishing wisdom says that this is crazy. But I credit my publisher for having the courage to try something new. Times were tough growing up, my editor Jeremy likes to joke. My father was a door-to-door Wikipedia salesman. Crowdsourcing the book, however, has made it so much better. The first version, for example, was written using only vowels. We've had thousands of people read Mind Hacking, and they've given us feedback ranging from typos and fact checks to major structural changes. Like Alan Downey's programming textbook, this has let us quickly iterate and test new versions of the book, seeing where people get stuck and pulling the difficult material forward, like Downey's analogy of pull-out bleachers. The takeaway: don't collaborate half-heartedly. Strive for radical collaboration. Swallow your pride. Take the attitude of a student and just get yourself out there. Stretch yourself. You'll learn all kinds of surprising things when you connect with other people. Like what you thought would be obvious often needs extra explanation. For example, by far the most common question we've received from our test readers is, "Do you mind if I share mind hacking? I know someone who really needs to read this book." So for the record, yes! Please share this book. Begin call out. For heaven's sake, collaborate. End call out. 3.5. Act. Quote, whether you wish to model a flower in wax, to serve a relish for breakfast or supper, to plan a dinner for a large party or a small one, to cure a headache, to bury a relative, whatever you may wish to do, make, or to enjoy, provided your desire has relation to the necessities of domestic life, I hope you will not fail to inquire within. Unquote. Editor's Introduction, Inquire Within Upon Everything. In the mid-1800s, Inquire Within Upon Everything was a popular encyclopedia found in many Victorian homes. It covered everything a modern family could possibly need to know, from the rules of etiquette to drafting a will. The first editions contained thousands of concise instructions on problems like getting rid of the bad smell in a freshly painted room, burn a handful of juniper berries, to how to administer an opium enema, 3 grains of opium, 2 ounces of starch, 2 ounces of warm water, then pass out. You can imagine a bright, curious child being absolutely spellbound by such a treasure trove of information, particularly before the invention of screens. Young Tim Berners-Lee, growing up in England in the 1960s, was lucky enough to have a copy of Inquire Within in his household, and he spent hours poring over its how-to instructions on parlor games, natural remedies, and household tips. There was something inspiring about this massive collection of random advice presented in a coherent structure. After graduating from Oxford in the 1970s with a degree in physics, Berners-Lee landed a contract job at CERN, the mother of all physics labs. In his research, he repeatedly found himself frustrated by needing some small bit of information that his mind refused to serve up, and his thoughts would frequently drift back to Inquire Within Upon Everything. If only there was a way to present all the world's information in some readily available format, so you could instantly pull up any random fact you needed. This was the vision that formed in his mind. All the world's information readily accessible. But it was only the first part of the vision. The second part was that, by getting all the information into computers, we could then use computers to help us crunch all that information. Once all the information was cataloged, all the information, computers could show us how to make our work more efficient, our relations more peaceful, our lives better. Berners-Lee didn't just sit around dreaming. He made a decision to act. His first attempt was a simple program that had pages of information called cards and hyperlinks between the cards. This system served 2 purposes. It let him share his projects with other CERN research scientists, but it also allowed him to easily access their projects. It was collaboration in action. Thinking back to the Victorian reference guide, he called the program Inquire. Inquire, like Newpedia, was ultimately not a success. It wasn't open enough. There were constraints around the types of information that could be linked, which turned out to be a deal breaker. One had to be able to jump from software documentation to a list of people to a phone book to an organizational chart to whatever, Berners-Lee recalled, once again invoking the mysteriously prophetic word, whatever. But Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither was the web. Berners-Lee took a job at a computer company, honed his networking skills, then returned to CERN in the 1980s. By the end of the decade, he was ready to act again. This time, all the pieces were in place. CERN was now the largest node on the internet, and the sheer volume of information at CERN was staggering. Some easy way of cataloging all that information was desperately needed. A number of technologies had been invented to facilitate the sharing of this information, but what Berners-Lee did was to put them together. I just had to take the hypertext idea and connect it to the transmission control protocol and domain name system ideas and ta-da, the World Wide Web. Although he makes it sound like an act of magic, nothing could be further from the truth. It was actually a series of carefully planned actions, of goals and sub-goals, of problems and solutions, before the inventor of the World Wide Web was able to invent the World Wide Web. First, he had to convince his boss to let him work on it. So in 1989, he wrote a proposal. With the dead sexy name of Information Management, a Proposal, the proposal was accompanied by a diagram that looked like a schizophrenic Christmas present, a collection of boxes, clouds, and lines interconnected in a flowchart from hell. It's no wonder that the proposal was rejected, although, in Berners-Lee's defense, how would you possibly illustrate the web to someone who's never seen it before? Undeterred, he acted again. With the help of a colleague, he revised the proposal, presumably adding more boxes and lines, and presented it again in 1990. This time, he got the go-ahead. If the story of the web was a video game, this was unlocking a major achievement, allowing Berners-Lee to level up. Now, the real work began. When Edison perfected an incandescent light bulb for the masses, he also had to invent hundreds of other parts to make the system work, from light switches to power meters to electrical wiring. He had to develop a method of running electrical wire into the home at a reasonable price. Then he had to create machines to generate electrical power, power plants to house the machines, and companies to run the power plants. The light bulb was a tiny piece. Edison's real genius was developing the system, lighting, the meta-system, electric power, then the meta-meta-system, the electric power industry. Similarly, Berners-Lee had to create the first web browser, the first web editor, and the first web server. The genius of Berners-Lee was that he was able to accomplish all these steps without being overwhelmed by the scale of the project. The magnitude of what he built is really astonishing, that he could see all these non-existent pieces in his mind and build them all one by one. Sir Tim, as he is now known, said that his key insight was going meta on the problem. It was a step of generalizing, going to a higher level of abstraction, thinking about all the documentation systems out there as being possibly part of a larger imaginary documentation system. I adore this story because it brings together so many pieces of the mind-hacking program. From thinking at a higher level, to visualizing what he wanted to achieve, iterating, collaborating, and finally, acting. An idea as big as the web in the sphere of a lesser mind would not have gone anywhere. But Sir Tim was able to take that idea and act. If you've ever been tripped up by procrastination, indecision, or just plain laziness on the way to your dreams, our final chapter will teach you skills to act. Based on the latest research, here's how to take your big ideas out of your mind and into the world. The power of tiny goals. David Blaine is the Harry Houdini of our time, an endurance artist who has performed record-breaking feats such as being encased in a block of ice for several days, buried underneath a 3-ton tank of water for a week, and sealed inside a plexiglass case dangling over the River Thames for a month and a half. If you're looking for someone who is able to accomplish difficult long-term goals, David Blaine is your man. To perform these feats of endurance, Blaine must be in top physical and mental condition. He eats well, reads regularly, does charity work, avoids alcohol, and is perfectly efficient with his time. Leading up to a stunt, Blaine is the model of discipline and self-control. Reportedly, he goes without food for up to a week before his stunts to avoid soiling himself while submerged in a tank. But in between his shows, David Blaine gets fat. In Roy F. Baumeister and John Tierney's Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength, Blaine admits that when he's not on the clock, he kind of lets himself go. After a stunt, I'll go from 180 pounds to 230 pounds in 3 months, he confesses. I waste a lot of time. I'll drink. I'll do silly things. Then, when it's time to get back in training mode, I'll drop about 3 pounds a week. So in 5 months, I'm completely transformed and my discipline levels are really high. The technique that Blaine uses to get back into shape is one that any of us can use, acting on tiny goals. When he goes back in training, he says, I make tons of weird goals for myself, like when I'm jogging in the park in the bike lane. Whenever I go over a drawing of a biker, I have to step on it. And not just step on it, I have to hit the head of the biker perfectly with my foot so that it fits right under my sneaker. He then explains the magic formula. Getting your brain wired into little goals and achieving them, that helps you achieve the bigger things you shouldn't be able to do. Think back to Dr. Richard Peabody, who had recovering alcoholics sit down at the end of each day and write down the next day's schedule. The power of that practice was that the alcoholic could make a list of tiny goals that could all be accomplished within 24 hours. Achieving those small goals creates a kind of rhythm, a positive momentum that slowly turns the alcoholic's negative spiral into a positive one. One of the reasons so many of us fail at our goals is that we try to take it all on at once. Every year at my health club, there is a huge influx of new members on January 1. Every workout machine is filled with sweaty people gasping for air trying to fulfill their New Year's resolutions. You can tell these folks are making the all-or-nothing kind of resolutions, such as, I will work out every day this year. Because every year, sometime around mid-January, they vanish. In mind hacking, you've imagined some big, hairy, audacious goals for yourself. In order to accomplish those goals, you're going to have to do the work. You have to act. And you will be much more likely to succeed if you break down your primary goal into a series of tiny goals, as small as you need. You don't get in shape by going to the gym every single day starting January 1st. You get in shape by going to the gym today. You don't stop smoking by vowing to never pick up a cigarette again. You stop for today. You don't earn $1 billion overnight. You work hard at earning money today. Sometimes, even the one day at a time approach is too much, and you need to break it down smaller still. If you can't make it to the gym regularly, try going for a walk at lunchtime. If you can't stay on a diet, try challenging yourself to drink a large glass of water. If you're trying to complete a huge project and you're so overwhelmed that you procrastinate working on it, try working on it for 15 minutes. Begin call out. Don't get around to it, just get up and do it. End call out. Finding the tiny goals that will help you move forward on the big goals is both an art and a science. Fortunately, there's an algorithm that will help you, or more accurately, an acronym. Focusing your mind like a laser. A laser is focused light. Light is all around us. In the sunlight outside, the fluorescent lights overhead, the screen that you may be staring into right now. A laser takes that light and focuses it into a high-powered beam that can cut through steel, destroy missiles from space, or accompany the Allman Brothers. In fact, LASER was originally an acronym for Light Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Radiation. I love that acronym because it shows a laser is essentially amplified light. Similarly, the energy of our minds is usually diffused over many different thoughts, fears, memories, and time-wasting daydreams. With mind hacking, we are focusing this mental energy, much as a laser powerfully focuses light into a diamond-cutting beam of power. This focused mental energy lets us set and accomplish the tiny goals that move us toward the big goals. Just like the original laser, there is an acronym that can help us define a good sub-goal, One that is limited, achievable, specific, evaluated, and repeatable. Limited. A good sub-goal is small. Dr. Peabody asked recovering alcoholics to list every item on their schedule for the next day, including periods of rest. For the alcoholic, crossing take a nap off a to-do list might seem silly, but it provides positive momentum. I set my mind to do this small thing, then I did it. A limited sub-goal like work on my app for 3 hours this week is better than add new feature X to app, since feature X may end up taking 40 hours. Achievable. A good sub-goal is something you can actually accomplish. Again, being able to point to a tiny goal that you achieved creates an upward spiral, where making progress motivates you to make more progress. I will exercise for 20 minutes 3 times this week is a better sub-goal than lose 40 pounds by May. Small successes tend to snowball into bigger successes. Specific. A good sub-goal is simple and clear. Most people have only a vague idea of what they want in life and a vague idea of how to go about getting it. The skills you're learning in this book are teaching you to be specific with your mind about what you want, and now you must be specific about the next step in getting there. For example, I will research online schools for 30 minutes today is a better sub-goal than the vague and fuzzy look into going back to college. Evaluated. It's important to figure out, did I do it? Write down your sub-goals so that you can come back on a daily and weekly basis and see whether you actually accomplished them. If not, why not? Evaluating your sub-goals can help you identify the issues that are holding you back. I was too busy. I got caught up in a TV show. I overslept. Figure out strategies for overcoming them and create better sub-goals in the future. Repeatable. Repetition is key. While some sub-goals are one-shot deals, enter motocross competition, introduce myself to world leader, the best sub-goals are the ones that you can turn into a regular habit, a flywheel of success. I will go to one support group this week. I will study for 30 minutes today. And I will practice my concentration game this morning are all tiny goals that will be immensely powerful if repeated over time, like a laser. An easy way to get started with these tiny goals is to simply ask, what's the next step? If you want to get free of your anxiety, what's the next step? Practice your concentration game today. If you want to start your own llama grooming business, what's the next step? Spend an hour researching competitors this week. If you want to win the Nobel Peace Prize, what's the next step? Get rid of your semi-automatic weapons. Then run them through the laser test and act. You already know the laser-like power of these tiny goals because you've been practicing them for years. When your fourth grade teacher gave you daily multiplication drills, when your boss asks you for a weekly status report, when a social media website encourages you to make your profile 100% complete, they're all leveraging the power of tiny goals. In mind hacking, we're now managing ourselves, setting tiny goals rather than having others set them for us. To paraphrase former U.S. Army Chief of Staff Creighton Abrams, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Sir Tim Berners-Lee didn't try to swallow the entire World Wide Web. He just took the tiny bite of drafting up a proposal for his boss. Day by day, piece by piece, he built the tools needed for the web to flourish. You can eat the elephant too if you focus on taking one bite at a time. Psychologist Richard Wiseman created a large-scale scientific survey involving over 5,000 participants trying to achieve big goals like the ones we've been discussing. losing weight, starting a business, and learning new skills. One of the key findings was that people who broke their goal into a series of tiny goals were far more successful. In essence, creating a step-by-step plan for getting to their goals. These plans were especially powerful, Wiseman reports, when the sub-goals were concrete, measurable, and time-based. Focused, in other words, like a laser. Skillfully defining these tiny goals, then acting on them, gives you a feeling of accomplishment and satisfaction. Tiny goals give you confidence to tackle bigger goals. Like a cartoon snowball rolling down a hill. I've never seen a real snowball do this, but it looks fantastic in cartoons. These little goals accumulate. Doing just a little bit builds your momentum to do more. But there's another reason to think in terms of tiny goals. It's fun. Your life is a video game. One of my favorite video games is called Beautiful Katamari, which is one of those fantastically insane creations that could only come from Japan. In the game, you start with a tiny sphere, a kind of sticky snowball called a katamari. Using your controller, you roll the sphere through different environments. A candy shop or a fast food restaurant. Rolling over random objects like poker chips and wheels of cheese, gradually making your katamari bigger. As the game progresses, your katamari gets big enough to roll through towns, picking up farm animals and boats. It's wildly hilarious to see struggling cows and people hanging on to the side of your katamari as it gathers mass. Then you move to the city level, picking up buildings and amusement park rides. Eventually, your katamari is big enough to roll over landmasses on the face of the Earth, until finally, you're in space, picking up planets and stars. There's an odd kind of satisfaction at each tiny accumulation in Beautiful Katamari, because our minds, especially geek minds, are wired to accumulate. This is something video game designers have known since the earliest days. The point system of Space Invaders begat the level system of Pac-Man, which begat the world system of Super Mario Brothers, which begat the current system of badges, leaderboards, hidden levels, unlockable weapons, and Easter eggs. There are even meta-scoring systems like Xbox's Gamer Score, which accumulates achievements across every Xbox game you've played. All these systems are based on tiny sub-goals. Complete this mission, finish this level, make it through this challenge. As we discussed at the beginning of this book, the geek mind loves to control and possess a small portion of the world, to know everything there is to know. It drives my kids crazy when we're playing a video game together and I have to find every hidden treasure, unlocking 100% of the characters and costumes. But this is the fun of video games, mastering tiny goals that give us tiny rewards, until one day, we've conquered the game. When we think of our personal sub-goals, like the missions in video games, we can shift our mindset from work to fun. After all, video games are a kind of work. You have to learn new skills, think through problems, and compete hard against other players. But somehow, it doesn't feel like work, because there are tangible rewards along the way. You can see how far you've come. Whatever your geek passion, whether it's collecting comics, learning LARPing, or studying stars, there's a feeling of accumulation, a feeling of mastery. Putting your tiny goals into the same mental model, whether it's earning points or collecting power-ups or completing 100% of your missions, is one of the best mind hacks I can recommend. Seeing your tiny goals as a geeky challenge keeps you motivated. Game designer Jane McGonigal sees life itself as a kind of video game. In her famous TED Talk titled The Game That Can Add 10 Years to Your Life, McGonigal shared how she used game thinking to heal herself from a debilitating head injury. After receiving a concussion that left her suffering from nausea, headaches, and mental fog, The advice from her doctor was just to let her brain rest. No reading, writing, or video games. In other words, she jokes, no reason to live. She did, in fact, begin to suffer from suicidal thoughts, which is common with traumatic brain injuries. The thoughts began to grow so pervasive and intense that they finally led her to a life-changing moment. "I am either going to kill myself," she vowed, "or I'm going to turn this into a game." She created a mental game for herself called Jane the Concussion Slayer. This was a mind hack where she awarded herself points for avoiding bad guys that triggered her symptoms, bright lights, crowded spaces, and more points for collecting power-ups that helped her heal, getting out of bed, taking a walk. Within a couple of days, she reports, the fog of depression and anxiety went away. While the cognitive symptoms and headaches took another year to heal, the game gave her the power to focus on tiny goals that eventually helped her achieve the big goals. This experience was the basis of not only McGonagall's TED Talk, but also her New York Times best-selling book, Reality is Broken: Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. In it, she argues that many of the world's greatest problems, from childhood obesity to global warming, can be solved by approaching them as video games, making tiny goals and achievements that, over time, can lead to epic wins. Throughout mind hacking, we've been presenting our exercises as mind games because there is a game-like component to mastering the mind. We must develop unfamiliar skills in a virtual world, working toward long-term goals while focusing on beating the current level. Now, as we move out of our mind and into the world, you can assign points to setting and achieving specific sub-goals, which keeps you motivated until you finally conquer the boss level and look with satisfaction at the end credits. Begin Mind Game. The Laser. Each day after your concentration game, write down your positive loops, then spend 60 seconds in mental simulation on one goal. Then write down one laser-focused sub-goal that will move you toward that goal, asking yourself, what's the next baby step? Write down and check off each sub-goal on your practice sheet. End mind game. Pushing the swing. Think about pushing a child on a swing set. If you want to get the kid swinging higher, when do you push? You get the most swing for your push if you do it at the beginning of the upswing, just as the child comes back and starts heading in the other direction. If you try pushing while the child is flying back towards you, your energy is wasted. You will actually slow down the swing and possibly break your finger. Now that's a weird concept. It's the same amount of force, but applied at one time on the swing cycle, it pushes the child higher, and at another time it slows the kid down. The swing, which is a pendulum, has a natural interval, a kind of beat or tempo. Pushing the swing in time with this tempo will cause it to go higher. In other words, small pushes, when timed correctly, can have big effects. In physics, this is called resonance, the natural tendency of objects to vibrate in sync with some external force. This concept is to be found throughout nature. Objects like organ pipes, quartz crystals, and yes, laser rods operate on the principle of resonance. Pluck the string on an acoustic guitar, and you're hearing the sympathetic vibrations of the finely crafted guitar body, which is why it sounds so much more beautiful than a rubber band stretched across a cardboard box. Acoustic resonance is how you shatter a crystal wine glass with sound played at the right resonant frequency. The glass molecules will vibrate in sync with the sound waves until eventually the glass breaks apart. There is also tidal resonance, such as in the Bay of Fundy off Maine, where the continental shelf is a width that amplifies the natural resonance of the ocean, causing the highest tidal range in the world. There is orbital resonance, where two orbiting bodies exert a regular gravitational pull on each other, such as that found between Earth and Venus. Resonance is so pervasive that Nikola Tesla once wrote, "If you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration." Which brings us back to our concept of tiny repeatable goals. When timed correctly, they can have big effects. I've always been a hard worker, even back in the days when I smoked a lot of marijuana. I was not the stereotypical stoner watching cartoons while eating Twinkies filled with Cheese Whiz. First, the Twinkies were usually filled with Nutella. Also, the weed gave me a kind of creative inspiration, the constant aha moments that fueled me to be even more creative. So I would always be working, following whatever ridiculous ideas my pot-soaked brain would dream up. While this occasionally produced some genuine inspiration, I see now that there was a lack of coherence to my efforts. One day I would be excited about creating a new social media project, the next day a t-shirt line. Most bakeheads are unable to see any projects through to completion, so I figured those rules didn't apply to me because I was able to get so much stuff done. However, getting stuff done is not nearly as important as getting the right stuff done. Much of the time I was pushing against the swing, pushing the kid out of the swing, or running underneath the child and getting bludgeoned by the swing. I was bewildered by how I could be working so hard and yet making so little progress. One of the tremendous gifts that sobriety gave me was the clarity to see the tiny goals that could have the biggest impact on my overall goals, and this plays out in every area of my life. It started with the daily goal of staying sober. Before sobriety, I spent an incredible amount of time thinking about how and when I was going to get high. I didn't want anyone to notice it, so I had to plan my day around finding a convenient place, getting rid of the smell, trying to act normally afterward, a cycle that would often be repeated several times a day. This consumed a ridiculous amount of mental energy. The small, repeatable goal of staying sober freed up all that mental energy. It was like I had been swimming with a cinder block chained to my waist, and I was able to remove the padlock and let the cinder block drop free. I was then able to focus all that newfound energy back on my own negative loops, gradually untangling the knots of buggy code, then reprogramming my mind to achieve more positive and constructive goals. Each day I practiced my concentration exercises. Each time I repeated my positive loops, I was pushing the swing a little higher. Like a pendulum, I found the system gives you energy back, swinging you higher and higher. I began making goals for the real world, expanding my business, my network, my vision of what we can achieve together. Once you find the natural cycle, you can gradually add energy to increase those cycles. With this book, with this crowdsourced system of mind hacking, my hope is that you can begin pushing your own swing higher and higher. And not just you, but thousands and millions of mind hackers worldwide. I can think of no higher swing than all of us learning how to harness the human mind together. Increasing your willpower. Let's say you make a tiny goal of walking for 5 minutes a day. No, I'm going to the gym every day until I can fit in a size 1 dress. Just, I'm going to park my car at the far end of the parking lot at work. And because this is a laser goal, you can actually achieve it. After a few weeks of accomplishing your goal, you're feeling pretty good. You find yourself saying, "Hey, I'm already walking. May as well walk around the parking lot once more before I go home." You tell a friend about your little experiment, and the two of you start doing it together. Then you find yourself thinking about how to log your walks. You spend the money for an exercise tracker, and now you and your friends start sharing data with each other. Maybe you start setting daily goals and sharing them via social network. Now you're taking longer walks over lunch, and soon you're finding that you have more energy and you're less winded than when you started. You realize you'd be even less winded if you stopped smoking, so you buy a box of nicotine patches and start drinking a lot of water instead. After a few weeks, you have even more energy, so you take the money you were spending on cigarettes and buy a cheap gym membership. You and your friend now meet before work, and you find that the early morning workout actually helps you get more accomplished on the job. After another few months of this, your boss dies of a meat-related heart attack, and noticing the amazing job you've done, senior management promotes you to his position at a 21% raise. Now you're not only feeling better, you're making more money, and you have more power. You begin to see ways of improving your small team, so you begin implementing some of the methods of mind hacking that you've learned here. After 6 months, your team is transformed into the highest performing team in the company, and senior management begins to take notice. At this point, you realize there is an amazing opportunity in this market that your company does not see. You quit your job and create an app that quickly grows to 100 million users. Within a year, a Chinese tech company offers to buy your app for $100 million, or a dollar per user. With that money, you join a group of investors trying to create a crowdsourced solution for worldwide peace. Recruiting the world's 1,000 richest people, the group pools together trillions of dollars, eventually overcoming the world's war budget and establishing planetary happiness. So you see, the 5-minute walk was time well spent. This is what author Charles Duhigg calls a keystone habit. Often, creating one positive habit, always through a series of laser-like goals, will start a domino effect with other positive changes. You often see this happen with recovering alcoholics. Within a year, they've not only stopped drinking, but quit smoking and lost weight and are having the best sex of their lives. It doesn't always happen this way, but it happens often enough to notice. One positive change can have cascading effects through your life. In Willpower, Baumeister and Tierney point to new research studies showing that willpower is a kind of energy, a battery that can be recharged. They outline various methods of increasing willpower, such as exercise, sleep, and concentration, which in turn increase your power to act. Similarly, the mind games throughout this book are designed to increase your mental energy, which will increase your willpower, which will increase your ability to make meaningful change in the world. The swing goes higher and higher. The final frontier. Here's a final question to ponder. Who are you? We started out by establishing that you are not your mind. But if you are not your mind, then who or what is the you? Thinking deeply about this question will reveal a weird recursive loop. If I am watching me, then who is the I who's watching that? It seems to echo back into infinity, like the long tunnel of reflections when you stand between two mirrors. The infinite video loop that occurs when you point a video camera at a monitor displaying the live feed. Audio feedback, which is sound from the speaker being amplified by the microphone in a self-reinforcing loop. Recursive acronyms, like Richard Stallman's GNU, which stands for GNU's Not Unix. But then, what does GNU stand for? Fractals, which are made of patterns that repeat themselves at any scale. Much of the work of M.C. Escher, such as the two hands drawing each other. The Department of Redundancy Department. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Who are you? You're the one viewing you. But then, who are you? Here is where we enter the realm of the philosopher and the mystic. But I want to encourage a more scientific, exploratory approach to this question. Embrace the question like a geek. After all, recursion, bits of code that can call themselves, is a central idea of programming. To calculate factorials, for example, we create a function that can continually call itself until all the factorials have been determined. To understand recursion, as the geek joke goes, one must first understand recursion. Finding the real you shows you the limits of our current models. There is no satisfying logical answer to the question because the you seems to always jump one step outside your objective mind. Even if you're a crazy smart logic genius who can hold six levels of recursion in your head, you're still an infinity away from solving the problem. Finding the you behind you is the ultimate mystery. Star Trek was wrong. Space is not the final frontier. This is the final frontier. This exploration beyond the mind. We've been calling this infinite frontier you, but that's as far as words can take us. We cannot put a name on it, because to name it is to bring it back into the realm of the mind. If we try to describe its attributes, we are only pulling away pieces of it, like taffy. What is behind the mind? This is what we have been leading up to, what all this work is about. As you learn to get your mind out of the way, to control it rather than being controlled by it, something else opens up. The you that's now controlling the mind, that mysterious frontier, is ultimately what we're after. Throughout this book are scattered clues that explain the nature of this frontier. They are hidden in every chapter. If you search for them diligently, you will find them. It is, I believe, life's most satisfying search. It's my sincere hope that the technology of mind hacking will help you change your mind for good. Welcome to day one of the Mind Hacking 21-Day Program. I'm Sir John Hargrave. All our life, wrote the great psychologist William James, is but a mass of habits. What you're going to learn with mind hacking is how to develop positive habits of thought, how to change your mind for good. There's a great book called The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg, and he opens with a story of this woman, Lisa, who was in a research study. Lisa's a smoker. She's overweight, she can't hold down a job, her credit cards are maxed out. She's a mess. She makes a decision to stop smoking, what Duhigg calls a keystone habit. It's a habit that has a domino effect on all the other areas of her life. She comes back into the research study a few years later, and the researchers literally do not recognize her. She's lost all the weight, she's running marathons, she's paid down her debt, has even bought a home. She's got a great job and starting her master's degree. Mind hacking is a keystone habit. It's a habit that will have a domino effect of positive changes throughout your life. And you've taken the first step in learning how to hack your mind. So I invite you to make a commitment. Right now, make up your mind that you will complete the full 21-day mind hacking program. Say to yourself, I will complete the 21-day mind hacking program. I will change my mind for good. Say it out loud. If you're in a public place, whisper. William James also said, in the acquisition of a new habit, we must launch ourselves with as strong and decided initiative as possible. Seize the very first possible opportunity to act in the direction of the habits you aspire to gain. And how hard is it, really? All you have to do is listen to a bunch of audio files. You can do this. Here's how it works. Listen to one recording a day. At the beginning, you can listen to these in your car or while you work out. But once we get into the concentration exercises, you'll need to listen with focus. Now, the research shows that we're far more likely to make a habit stick if we set up a cue and a reward. For example, if you want to exercise more often, you just put on your workout clothes first thing as soon as you get out of bed. You don't have to work out, just put on the yoga pants, which serves as your cue, your reminder. Then always give yourself a reward when you've completed the habit. Make it positive, healthy, and easy to do. So, for example, coffee, or a shower, or a smoothie. Give yourself the reward only on the days you cultivate the habit, like you're training a dog. Today's exercise, then, is to set up a cue and a reward for the mind hacking program. Now, if you own the hard copy book, it's ingeniously designed to serve as both. Just leave that bright yellow book on your nightstand, which is your visual cue, and each day mark off your exercises in the back of the book, which is the reward. If you don't have a hard copy of the book, you can buy one, or you can use a pad of paper or sticky notes, which you can leave on your nightstand. I recommend writing the words, "Hello World," on the top page, which is the traditional first program that you write when you're learning a new computer language. It's also friendly, and who doesn't want a friendly pad of paper on their nightstand? You can decide on a second reward, something that's easy and pleasurable for after you complete your mind hacking exercises. Here's what I do. I do my mind hacking exercises in the morning. I do my concentration exercises, then I have some tea or coffee while I'm repeating my positive loops. First thing in the morning, because if I try to do it before bed, I fall asleep. That's my routine, but you can find your own. The important thing is to be consistent with your cue and your reward. This is how you develop a new habit, and this is how you train your mind. The rewards of mind hacking are incredible. Whether you want to lose weight, start a business, improve your relationships, you're going to learn the tools for making those dreams a reality. Because everything starts in your mind. Congratulations, you have conquered day one. Mark it off in the book, or on your practice sheet, or in the Mind Hacking app, which you can download at www.mindhacky.ng. Set up your cue. Give yourself a reward, and I'll see you tomorrow. Until then, hack hard and prosper. Welcome to day two of the Mind Hacking 21-Day Program. I'm Sir John Hargrave. You've crossed a major milestone just coming back for day two. You're starting a positive habit, which is going to rocket your life in exciting new directions. To paraphrase Gandhi, he said, "Your thoughts become your actions become your habits, and your habits become your destiny." I don't know why he said it in that Hollywood movie voice, but that's what he said. What we're doing with mind hacking is learning new habits. We're learning new habits of thought, which will lead to new habits of action, which will change your destiny. I was listening to this woman tell this story about her terrible posture and how it was caused by a middle school trauma of not having any boobs. She went through life with this habitual thought, which was, "I am flat-chested." So she'd buy these baggy shirts, then slump her shoulders so people wouldn't know exactly what was going on in there. Thought, "I'm flat-chested." Action, slumping and baggy shirts. Destiny, poor lifetime posture. I know another guy who was totally out of shape. He would eat a full bag of Cheetos every night while he watched TV. His fingernails were like constantly stained orange. It was disgusting. So a couple of his coworkers get into running, and a few of them do half marathons. And one day he decides, well, if they can do it, so can I. His thought is, "I can run a half marathon." His action is that he starts training. Then he has more energy. He spends less time on the couch. He cuts down to half a bag of Cheetos and then eventually switches over to popcorn. Destiny runs the half marathon in the best shape of his life. Your thoughts become your actions become your habits, and your habits become your destiny. You can think of examples from your own life of how